From the heart of our nation's capital, this is Washington Watch Weekend Edition. Now, here's your host, David Salkeld.
This week on the Weekend Edition of Washington Watch, the Biden administration gets a seat on the Supreme Court. U.S.-Russian tensions rise. Mask mandates still not out of the question, and big tech more willing to help China than their home country. Greetings, fellow patriots. I am David Salkeld, and I'm a constitutional conservative, Christian husband, and Reagan Republican. With many on the left wondering what was taking so long, Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer announced his retirement. Here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins with more on this announcement.
Well, many court watchers are holding their collective breaths to hear who President Biden will nominate to replace retiring Justice Stephen Breyer, the senior most liberal on the U.S. Supreme Court bench. While whoever Biden nominates will not tip the current 6-3 conservative ideological balance, the person will be continuing the liberal legacy of the court, perhaps even outdoing Breyer, Justice Sotomayor, and Kagan in terms of wokeness. Joining me now with the latest on this story is Jeff Murdoch. He's White House reporter for The Washington Times. Jeff, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me, Tony. I appreciate it.
All right. So what do we know in terms of when this nomination will take place?
President Biden said today he expects to have a nomination in place, a nominee in place by the end of February. He said it'll be a rigorous process, and he's going to consult lawmakers of both parties, as well as legal scholars, on who his pick should be.
So did the president renew his campaign promise to nominate a black female to Breyer's seat?
Yes, he did. That was a campaign promise he made, that the first opportunity he would nominate a black woman to the Supreme Court. There's never been a black woman on the Supreme Court, so it's a historic nomination. It's also a chance for a reset for the president. He's had a string of losses legislatively, politically, and this will be a chance to give him a much needed victory.
Any thoughts as to who the leading contender might be?
There are two candidates, Ketanji Brown Jackson, who is a district court judge here in D.C., a circuit court judge, I should say, here in D.C., and Leandra Kruger, who is a California Supreme Court justice. There are a couple of other candidates, Michelle Childs, who's being favored by Representative Claiborne. She's from South Carolina, but it sounds like it's going to be between Brown Jackson and Kruger.
This discussion about the vice president being tapped, is that just inside political rumor that is circulating?
It doesn't make any sense for the president to appoint Vice President Harris, because if she gets confirmed on the court, then the Democrats would lose their ability to break deadlocks by having the vice president come in and vote. So if the president put up a successor to Vice President Harris, then the Republicans decided that they are going to block that successor, there would be nobody to come in and break the tie, and then we would not have a vice president, which could be problematic for this administration. It would be both embarrassing as well as just create some difficulty in terms of getting things done.
Yeah, and I was even trying to verify today, I couldn't get an answer from those in the Senate as to whether or not the vice president could actually vote on her nomination, whether or not she would have to recuse herself, which then could lead to a 50-50 deadlock in the Senate.
I've asked that question, too. I've also not been able to get an answer. Legal scholars seem split. We've never had a sitting vice president nominated to the Supreme Court. So it's uncharted territory.
One final question for you, Jeff. Does this have any liability for Democrats in the midterm election? I mean, there's a lot of concern. You know, last four election cycles, we've had vacancies on the court. This one doesn't shift the ideological makeup. But if the president really picks someone to the left, could this be a liability for Democrats in some of these swing states?
I think it cuts both ways. I think it's something that's going to energize the Democratic base ahead of the midterms, but it's also going to mobilize Republicans. I think both sides are going to see this, and it's going to see the ideology of the candidate that the president's going to put forward. It's going to motivate both sides to be active, and especially with the midterms right down the road.
All right. Jeff Murdoch, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your insights. All right, shifting gears to international concerns. Last night, the U.S. Ambassador to Russia, John Sullivan, delivered the Biden administration's written response to concerns the Kremlin had expressed during the ongoing standoff between Russia and Ukraine. According to news reports, the, quote, written document was intended to address concerns Moscow has publicly released and to outline areas where the U.S. has said it sees potential progress for Russia or with Russia, arms control, transparency and stability, the top U.S. diplomat told reporters at the State Department, end quote. But apparently, the Kremlin was not impressed by the White House response. Today, the Russian foreign minister was quoted as saying there is no positive reaction on the main issue in this American document. The main issue is over our clear position on the inadmissibility of further expansion of NATO to the east and the deployment of strike weapons that could threaten the territory of the Russian Federation. Joining me now with the latest on this ongoing crisis is Senator Roger Wicker of Mississippi. He is a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee and was recently in Ukraine meeting with Ukrainian officials. Senator, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Tony. Glad to be back on.
So I know you took a trip with it was a bipartisan trip with other senators over to Ukraine. You met with President Zelensky. You've been a part of briefing the Biden administration. Is the Biden administration responding appropriately to the situation?
They're responding better than the Obama administration did. I will have to say I would like to have seen a little more of a muscular response. But also this comes in the context of everything else that's happening. You know, when Leon Panetta, who served in the Democratic Obama administration, says the world sees weakness coming from this administration over Afghanistan, over our defense policy, I think it's pretty telling that someone like that's a dedicated Democrat would say the world sees weakness. And I think that is the sort of thing that gives Putin ideas about returning to what Ronald Reagan called the evil empire, and that's a return of something like the USSR, where Russia controls its neighbors, where they're not free, they don't have the ability to have a market economy, and they don't have the ability to elect their own leaders. So to the extent that we are saying we're willing to send weapons over there, I applaud that, and I want to be bipartisan about it, and I hope that some of the stronger members on the Democratic side of the Armed Services Committee can continue to give the president some backbone and spine on this issue.
Now, Senator Wicker, you have said that the time for diplomacy alone has ended, that we're now at a point where a more aggressive stance is needed. Is that the sending of weapons to Ukraine? Is that what you're suggesting? Or is there more the U.S. can do?
Well, here's what I don't ever believe in doing. I believe in following the Eisenhower doctrine, which every president, Democrat and Republican, has followed. We don't rule anything out. No president has ever done that until this one. So I'd leave all options on the table. But clearly, the Ukrainians and the Europeans are capable of defending themselves if we'll supply them with the proper armaments. But I would not rule out. I just wouldn't take anything off the table because it's a bad option.
I agree. This,
from having talked to the defense minister over there in Kiev, the foreign minister, and the president of the country, the freely elected president, who got 75% in the last election, the Ukrainians have the resolve never to go under the Russian thumb again. They remember how it was not to be free.
Right.
And they're listening also to what Putin's saying to the neighbors. Putin also said, not only do we not want Ukraine ever, ever to be a member of NATO, even if they freely choose to do that, we want Bulgaria and Romania to leave NATO and come back into sort of a non-aligned status. There's no way we're going to agree to that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right, Senator Wicker, having worked with some of those Eastern Bloc countries, previously Eastern Bloc countries, the understanding and taste of communism still exist, and those that taste it don't want to go back. You're absolutely right. We just need to stand with them and help them. Senator Roger Wicker, always great to talk with you. Thanks so much for stopping by today.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
All right. Coming up next, we'll be talking with Professor Bob Destro about a proposal to create a database to track those who request religious exemptions to the president's vaccine mandate. That's coming up next here on Washington Watch. Don't go away.
Most of us have at least one friend or family member who is pro-choice or have engaged with someone who doesn't share our pro-life views. As Christians, we are called to defend the weak and to speak truth in love. When we advocate for the unborn, we must do so in a way that is both truthful and loving so that people will listen, both for their benefit and the unborn. At Family Research Council, we recognize and respect the inherent dignity of every human life, from conception until natural death. The value of human life is not conditional upon its usefulness to others or the state, or an arbitrary evaluation of a person's, quote, quality of life. Rather, the value of human life is unconditional because God, the author of life, has created all humans in his image and likeness. FRC's Center for Human Dignity exists to give a voice to the voiceless by helping others speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. Access our free resources so that you can address abortion, human trafficking, pornography, and more. Speak truth boldly and lovingly. Learn how at frc.org/life.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, your host. Good to have you with us. The website, tonyperkins.com. All right, a number of nations backing away from the government overreach as it comes to, as it pertains to the coronavirus. In fact, Denmark Prime Minister announcing today that, or actually yesterday, that Denmark is throwing out most of the COVID-19 pandemic restrictions that it has put in place. Even Finland is going to begin easing its restrictions in mid-February. That means the mask mandates are gone, some of the vaccine mandates. While, and we've been talking about this before, Britain doing the same thing, but the United States, it looks like we're doubling down. The administration continues to fight for its mandates, but now there's a suggestion or evidence to suggest that the federal government is considering the creation of a database to keep information on every federal employee, volunteer, intern, contractor, or consultant who request a religious exemption from the government's vaccine mandate. This be a bad idea or a really bad idea? Joining us now to discuss this is someone well-equipped to answer this question, Catholic University professor of law and former commissioner on the United States Commission on Civil Rights, Bob Destro. Bob, welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks, Tony, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what do we know about this and the government's creation of this registry to track and or at least keep on file everyone who's requested a religious exemption to their mandate?
Well, we don't know much about it. It appeared in the, we call the Federal Register, which is the official announcement of a proposed rulemaking for the federal government. And so all we know is that they're going to do this. We have no idea where they get the authority. We have no idea where they get the data. We have no idea what they're going to use it for. And so to answer your question in the intro, is it a bad idea or a really bad idea? I would say it's a horrific idea.
I mean, what would they do with this? Track people to see if they go to church, to see if their religious exemption is legitimate? Is it a form of intimidation? I mean, We've long protected our privacy in this country, and seems like, especially in this pandemic, we've accelerated the overreach of the government.
Well, I think we've accelerated the overreach of the government for a long time. I mean, if we go back to even to 9/11, we've pretty much acquiesced in saying that they have a right to pat us down at the airport. You know, yeah. A lot of people would argue about that, but, you know, but it's worth looking at. With respect to this question, are they, you know, what are they using? Why do they need the information other than to create a list of people who oppose their mandate?
Right. And to go back to your example of 9/11, I was a vocal opponent of the private Patriot Act, and have remained so, even when it was all embraced by Republicans. Because I said, there's coming a day when you're not going to have a George W. Bush in the White House and a fairly conservative administration. You're going to have one that's going to use this against us, and voila, what did we find? That's exactly what they did against President Trump as a candidate. They used the Patriot Act and the authority given to them. You always have to look at this. I'm not a pessimist. I'm a realist. You have to look at all of these policies in how they in the worst way that they can be used.
Well, there's no question, and the idea that there is actually a right to privacy anymore, and that's going to be the big human rights issue to come. I mean, why are they collecting all this data? Who is collecting the data? What are they collecting it about? And it's not just the government that's collecting it. Google and Facebook, I mean, you know, basically they know more about you than you know about yourself. And the use of that data is just one of many questions. But why the D.C. Government is doing it completely eludes me. And everybody needs to complain about it, write in, and make comments about it. And then as soon as it goes into effect, they need to be sued.
So let me ask you this question, Bob, because a lot of these government databases, you know, like IRS is supposed to, you know, that's private information, although it's been hacked into or it's been released for political purposes. But a lot of the information that the government collects is open to researchers and others. I mean, what do we know about the protections that we would have over this information that they collect?
We don't know much about it at all. And it's getting worse. I mean, Maxine Waters has asked for the credit scoring agencies to be taken over by the federal government, which would give the government access to all of our credit information. The IRS wants a report of every transaction of over $600. I mean, basically what we're doing is we're collecting all these databases, and then we can use it, we can match it with some kind of, whether it's a vaccine passport or even a microchip like they're going to try and use in Switzerland and Sweden to track us constantly. That's what the Chinese do.
I was fixing to say, this sounds very much like communist China.
Well, actually, communist China got the idea from us, and most of the Communist Party face recognition software came from the United States. Companies like Honeywell and other American companies basically helped the Chinese put it together.
Interesting you mentioned that. That's my next topic in the next segment, talking about how the mega tech firms that are silencing conservatives here in this country have been getting rich off the Chinese by helping them in their artificial intelligence efforts.
Yeah, and you know, more to the point that you made before, the Chinese have just announced that anybody who criticizes China during the Olympics is in trouble. You know, guess what? We have that same problem here. And what we have now is American capitalism with Chinese characteristics.
Well, I don't think I can get in any more trouble with China. I've already been sanctioned by China, so I don't know what's next. Bob Destro, always great to talk with you. Thanks so much. We're going to keep an eye on this, and I'm also going to track it down and make sure we can put this out for people to comment on this rulemaking process.
Very good. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Always great to see you. Take care. Bob Destro, Catholic University law professor, but also was in the Trump administration at the Department of State. All right, coming up next, Peter Schweitzer, author of Red Handed, How American Elites Get Rich Helping China Win. He's here to share more about his book. You don't want to miss this interview. We're coming back right after the break with more Washington Watch. Don't go away.
Religious freedom is the freedom to hold religious beliefs of one's choice and to live according to those beliefs. So, Why should we care about it? Not just domestically, but also internationally? At Family Research Council, we care about religious freedom because we believe it is an essential human right that all governments have an obligation to protect. Tragically, religious persecution is a disturbing reality around the world, one that is rarely acknowledged by the media, even though attacks on people of all faiths are increasing in many regions around the world. Christians are called to care for the persecuted church, the downtrodden, and those who cannot defend themselves. That is why we must be advocates for the persecuted. Go to frc.org/IRF to check out Family Research Council's latest resources on international religious freedom. Learn what steps you can take to help the cause of the persecuted again by visiting frc.org/IRF.
This is Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Good to have you with us. Website, TonyPerkins.com. It's no secret that big tech in Silicon Valley are not friendly to the conservative cause. But are the ambitions of the Silicon Valley elites also helping one of America's biggest rivals on the world stage and one of our biggest enemies? Well, that's the question my next guest answers in his new book, Red Handed, How American Elites Get Rich Helping China Win. The author, Peter Schweitzer, joins me now. Peter, welcome to Washington Watch.
Great to be with you, Tony. Thanks for having me.
So let me just start with this. What is the ultimate goal of the Chinese Communist Party's collaboration with Silicon Valley?
Well, they're quite explicit about it. They have a strategy called elite capture. And basically what it is, Tony, is their goal, and they've stated this openly, is to surpass the United States and to become the supreme power on the planet. And rather than going toe-to-toe with the United States and our powerful economic system, they simply want to co-opt elites. So they call it elite capture. And their theory is if they can neuter our elites, they can effectively win this competition without having to go head-to-head with the United States.
President Xi has said that science and technology is a national weapon. Is Silicon Valley helping China achieve that that goal?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are numerous examples I cite in the book where Silicon Valley titans suck up to Xi in all kinds of ways. But in a very real material sense, we know that Microsoft, we know that Google are doing joint research projects where they are putting in capital, they are putting in intellectual capital into China. And those research projects are with institutions linked to the Chinese military. And they are doing research on artificial intelligence, which President Xi has said is the technology that will give them the, quote, commanding heights in their competition with the United States. There are numerous other examples as well. Bill Gates, for example, personally has invested in Chinese companies, a company BYD, for example, which is involved in developing missile technology for China. So there is a very serious problem that these tech executives don't have an allegiance to the United States that we would expect and don't seem to be particularly concerned that they are subsidizing and helping the Chinese military.
I mean, Peter, there's no secret that the Chinese military, there's no firewall between them and the private sector tech companies in China. They have access to everything.
That's right. In fact, they are required by law. There's legislation that calls for civilian-military fusion. So if you are a civilian company in China, you're required by law to turn over military-related applications. And the problem is that Silicon Valley executives don't seem to be particularly concerned about this. In fact, Microsoft as a company actually takes interns from the Chinese People's Liberation Army. I mean, it's that blatant. And they don't seem to be particularly concerned that this is going on.
So, Peter, before I go further with some more questions, where can folks get a copy of your book, Red Handed?
You can find it on any online site. It's number one on Barnes & Noble and on Amazon, and you can find it in bookstores around the country.
Okay, so, Peter, this is probably a question that's on the minds of many people. What's the motivation here? Is this all about money?
It's a great question. A part of it's money, but when you consider a guy like Bill Gates, who's worth $100 billion, does he really need more money? I think there's something else at work here, Tony. I actually quote in the chapter on Silicon Valley a professor from MIT in the 1970s named Professor Wiesenbaum, and he describes the fact that computer programmers can develop a kind of godlike complex because they get to construct with coding the universe in which things behave in this platform. So you think about Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg and his programmers are the ultimate arbiters. What you find, Tony, is that a lot of these executives in Silicon Valley and on Wall Street have an admiration for the dictatorial regime in China. They'll use phrases like, you know, the Chinese government's so much more efficient than the United States. They make decisions so much more quickly. Well, of course, autocratic governments have that advantage. So it's about more than just money. I think there is actually an attraction, not so much maybe to the ideology, but to the efficiencies of an autocratic government, plus the fact that, of course, the Chinese government gives all kinds of awards and accolades to these business executives.
But clearly they have to know that they're jeopardizing that national security. I mean, you had this joint project between Google and Facebook with this underwater cable going to Hong Kong with the Chinese firm connected to the Chinese government. The U.S. Federal Trade Commission blocked that last year or in 2020. I mean, they got to see this.
Yeah. I mean, that's the cable's a perfect example. I mean, Facebook and Google decide to finance this cable that's going to connect Hong Kong with San Francisco. And as you point out, they hire a military contractor in China to do that construction. And it's only because the FBI and the Justice Department says that this would create an unprecedented opportunity for Chinese espionage that the project is halted. Now, you know, I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess that the people at Facebook and at Google know a lot more about technology than the Department of Justice. So if the Department of Justice knows that this has created an unprecedented opportunity for espionage, you can bet that Google and Facebook knew that from the beginning. But I think, honestly, they just didn't care because they're blinded by their ambitions as it relates to China.
Amazing. Very dangerous. Peter, great to have you on the program. We're going to talk more about this because I think it is fascinating and it's something the American people need to know. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. God bless, Tony.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. I'm David Salkeld, thanking you for being with us. I look forward to having you back here again next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
Washington Watch Weekend Edition is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com.